one of the like biggest, best piece of advice that my advisor gave, and I'll give it again, and I try to give it to all my students, is to have your own scholar identity. Like, do something that is yours, that you care about, that you want to devote your time to. How much ever time that might be. You know, because it's really tough to like want to continue to write and work and analyze. And if you don't love it, or at least have a very strong liking, it will become insurmountable very quickly.
Welcome to another episode of Innovation Insights, where we dive deep into the minds shaping the future of industries through innovation, creativity, and groundbreaking research. We believe that innovation happens in all aspects of life. I am your host, Dr. Yolanda Sanders. Today, we have the privilege of speaking with Dr. Sarah L. Rodriguez, an associate professor of engineering education at Virginia Tech, where she also serves as an affiliate faculty member with the higher education program. Dr. Rodriguez's research addresses systemic inequities within engineering and computing education, focusing specifically on the experiences of historically marginalized student populations. Through a lens that incorporates identity and critical frameworks, her work dives deep into issues of equity, access, and retention, strongly emphasizing STEM, science, technology, engineering, and math, identity development, and intersectionality. A seasoned collaborator and grantmaker, Sarah has led and partnered on numerous large-scale interdisciplinary research projects, amassing approximately $20 million in funding from prestigious institutions like the National Science Foundation, the KPOR Center, and the Center for the Study of Community Colleges. Her scholarly contributions include over 40 peer-reviewed articles, numerous book chapters, and countless national and state conference presentations. Sarah's commitment to translating research into practice is evident in her role as an implementation coach for the Charles A. Dana Center's Mathematics Pathways, and as an affiliate to initiatives such as Project MALES and the Center for Community College Student Engagement. Recognized for her early career achievements, she has received accolades like the Early Career Award from the American Association of Hispanics in Higher Education and the Barbara K. Townsend Emerging Scholar Award from the Council for the Study of Community Colleges. Welcome to the podcast, Sarah. We're so glad to have you here on Innovation Insights.
Yeah, excited to be here.
Well, I've known you for a while. I met during your time at Iowa State University when you were a new faculty member. I think I remember meeting you at like a new faculty member lunch or like mentorship lunching, and you were there with one of your mentors at the lunch, and we were all sitting at the same table. And then we have mutual friends. Dr. Shannon Coleman, who will also be on the podcast too.
Yay.
So,
yeah, love Shannon.
Yes, I do too. But it's been fun over the years to watch your career as a new faculty member, and then for you to really hone your brand as an academic. Just really, really proud of the work that you've done. Tell us a little bit about your journey into academia.
Yeah, you know, you knew me when I was a baby faculty member, a super baby faculty member. It feels wild that it's 10 years out. So this is kind of a nice, like, culminating 10-year kind of moment in my career. So in terms of, you know, the journey to academia, and I feel like it's a continuous journey. Like, I don't feel like the journey ever really stops. But I will say, like, it really all stemmed from being a Gates Millennium Scholar in high school, and they you know, the Gates Millennium Scholarship Program is a 10-year fully funded experience for students, underrepresented students of color, low income, academically talented. And they put into our minds very early, like, you're going to get a PhD, you're going to go change the world. So good luck. And so that's just what I thought we were supposed to do. And so I figured out where I could do a PhD and how I could do it. And I actually ended up going to the University of Texas at Austin. I thought I would never go back to Texas for my PhD. I thought I was going to go to New York or California. Texas was the last thing on my mind, really. And then my dissertation, who later became my dissertation chair, Victor Sines, he called me on the phone and just said, I don't know what to tell you. The other schools are really great, but I'm going to invest in you as a person for the rest of your life. And I remember exactly where I was, like, when he told that to me. And I said, okay, like, this is it. And I had already accepted another institution. I called him back and said, absolutely not. I'm going to Texas. And from there, I, you know, did all the typical things that graduate students do to get to the faculty life, in terms of presenting and all of that. And my first job was at Iowa State. So I didn't even know where Iowa was whenever I applied or had an on-campus interview. So I found that out the day or so before where Iowa was and, you know, what Iowa was about. And, you know, as a Latina, young Latina woman at that point, that was a huge step of faith to go somewhere where I didn't know anybody, didn't know anything about it. And just said, okay, well, I'm going to go do this thing. And it worked out really lovely. And I loved my time as a new faculty member. And I've just kind of kept going, kept moving. And now I'm in engineering ed, which is a field shift, but still kind of doing the same thing, but just from a little bit different perspective.
Well, one thing that you said there that... I really hope that individuals that are thinking about graduate programs do is really make sure that they find a mentor in that grad program. And that was very, very smart of you to, you know, to have, you know, when he said this, that, you know, I'm going to invest in you for the rest of your life, that, that you're like, okay, this is what I need to follow. Could you tell us a little bit more about that investment that you made? Because I think sometimes when people are looking for graduate programs, they don't realize that it's really important that the people who are in the program.
Yeah. I mean, I had been accepted to other schools and, like, I had met with faculty and, you know, like, we had similar research interests and, you know, I thought, oh, it's going to be fine. Right. It probably would have been, honestly. But I don't know. There's something about somebody telling you that they're going to invest in you for a lifetime that just really moved me. And, you know, then when I got there, I was like, oh, no, what if it doesn't pan out? What if he was just lying to me? He hasn't stopped investing. Like, I called him maybe like 3 weeks ago. Like, I mean, he was at my wedding, like all of these things. But like in graduate school, what that looked like was, from the very first semester, I was involved in research. I was presenting, sometimes by surprise. Like, he was like, oh, come to this conference. And then when we get in the car, he's like, okay, you're going to present. So good luck. You have 2 hours to prep. You know, fun things like that. So, you know, he had me out there. He was like, you are a leader. You understand, like, what the research is. He would take me along to funder meetings. And say, this is, you know, my research coordinator, like, she can answer questions about the research project. He had me going to dinners. He had me, you know, flying places when he couldn't go there. He allowed me to really craft my scholar identity, too. Like, I remember him sitting down and he was like, look, I really love the work that you do with the project, but I want to make sure you have your own scholar identity. You have your own stuff that you're working on. And that was a moment that I didn't really understand, like, what the investment was there. But he made me, like, carve out where my space was. And that made all the difference, like, going towards the faculty track, because he was supportive, but he acknowledged that, like, I had to make my own way. Like, he was going to do everything he could, like, give me all the contacts, all the, like, opportunities to get in front of the right people. But, you know, it had to be my stuff. And, you know, in terms of moving forward, like, that investment has looked like helping me negotiate to get the best packages that I could multiple times. You know, making sure that I get asked to be on certain projects, putting my name in whenever, you know, whenever he can. So it's really, there's a cool book that's called You Don't Need a Mentor, You Need a Sponsor, or something to that effect. And that's really what he was really like advocating for me when I wasn't in the room.
And that is really great that you mentioned a sponsor. I'm working with a group of women at another university, and we meet once a month, and there's probably about 40 women that are in it. And we talk about mentorship, sponsorship, coaching, the differences between them. And that's, you really need to have someone that does all of those. So thank you for really, you know, identifying that aspect. And sometimes someone can do all of it.
Yeah. Dude, and not to say that I just had one, like, there's a whole constellation of, like, behind the scenes Sarah people that make this whole thing possible.
Yes. And you need that. And I love the fact, too, that, you know, you talked about carving out your own identity as a scholar, and that he found that that was really important and made sure that that happened. Because sometimes what happens in graduate programs, if you're working in a research lab or with a scholar, you really just stay underneath what they're doing, just their projects, and not that opportunity to build your own path. So talk to us a little bit about the path that you have taken on your own for your research focus, because it's fascinating.
Yeah. So the path is windy, I guess. Like, so I remember when I first, like, started trying to figure out what my research agenda was, I was on a men's project, right? Latino men was really the focus. And so I did a lot of thinking about men and masculinities and what that meant in the context of higher ed. And that was really awesome. And I continue to do some of that work today. But for my dissertation, like, I really wanted, A, to make my own way, but B, like, I wanted to focus on women. I wanted to spend the next, like, how many ever years of my life talking about women. And so I remember when my dissertation chair was like, hey, what are you going to do? I was like, okay, Latinas, because I want to keep talking to Latinas. I want it to be about identity, because identity is extremely important to me in all facets of my life. And particularly my research. And I was like, where better to think about women and identity than in STEM fields? Because, you know, we don't have enough Latinas in STEM fields, and especially, and later on, engineering and computing. And so, you know, I started down this road, and so many people were like, oh, you're just chasing money. You're just chasing, like, the cool, hot thing that's, you know, going on right now. And, you know, that was a little bit hurtful sometimes when people would say that, because what they didn't know, and what I didn't choose to unpack for a real long time, was the fact that I wanted to be an engineer. I wanted to be in STEM. But, like, coming from a rural, low income, person of color background, I didn't see anybody. I didn't even see any engineers, period. I think I knew one engineer growing up, and he was like super ag engineer. So that didn't resonate. White older man. So I had no frame of reference, right? But I still wanted to do it. I was a high school aerospace scholar with NASA. I went to space camp, like, that sort of thing. You know, but it never resonated. Like, I didn't see people who looked like me. I didn't see opportunities to really engage with STEM. And so it was my goal to make sure that other Latinas didn't feel that way. That, you know, if they wanted to do STEM, that they could. And so that really took me into a different direction. And so when I got to Iowa State, I was
honestly didn't know anybody, right? Like, not really. And all of a sudden, some like very industrious small woman like started sending me emails and finding me at conferences. And I was like, who is this woman? And she was very persistent. And I'm like, who is this woman? What is she doing? And she wants to collaborate with me. And I don't know her. And I finally, like, she was just like, yeah, well, we'll add you to the team. And it turns out that it was Diane Rover, who is prolific in engineering education spaces. And she just kind of wrote me into like some of the grants. And she was like, I think you're a great fit. Got looped in by Craig Ogilvy, who was also at Iowa State at the time. And I didn't know who Craig was. You gotta know who these people were, but we resonated with each other. Like, they cared about racial climate. They cared about gender climate. And I'm like, okay, well, let's work together. And only later did I really find out that they were, you know, extremely prolific in their fields, that they deeply cared about the same issues that I did, not just in a cursory, you know, get NSF funding kind of way. And so that really launched me into this engineering education space. And then making that huge shift in 2022, I made the shift to change fields mid-career, which is not for the faint of heart. Like, I would not recommend necessarily doing it. But like the perspective that you have when you switch fields and you're able to be successful in your own field and you can be successful in another field, you know, it's a great feeling personally. And also, I think that I bring a lot to the field of engineering education because I think differently than some of the people in this field.
You know, so you had to have a lot of trust and a lot of faith to make, you know, some of these leaps to, you know, to work with individuals that were approaching you at conferences or, you know, here at Iowa State that, you know, you didn't know, or, you know, to make that jump into a whole different discipline and field. I mean, how did you do that? I mean, what was the gut instinct that you have, like, okay, I can do this?
Yeah, I don't know. My mom has always said that, like, my family, we have a sense of knowing that we really tap into. You just know. Like, you know when something is good, you know when something isn't good, and you trust that. And even when you're scared, like, if it feels like you listen, you have to listen. But if it feels like the right choice, then you do it. And that's not to say that, like, I haven't made poor choices or that things, you know, always went my way. Like, I mean, academia is littered with all the shadow CV of things that didn't work out. But I will say that, like, even when it didn't work out, like, I still think that it was the right move, like, because I trusted myself. And so, you know, I think that it also just takes some fearlessness to do some of those things. Like, I remember everybody was like, why are you moving to Iowa? Iowa's so hard. Oh my gosh. So, like, white and difficult. And I'm like, well, if you're going to do the work, like, shouldn't that be where you're doing the work? I mean, I don't need to do the work in South Texas. I mean, there is work to be done all over, but, like, that's not my work. My work is going where it's hard. And so, you know, I also made a leap of faith, like, packing up my husband and my one-year-old and coming to Virginia, like, pretty much him sight unseen. I was reflecting recently that, like, I moved a one-year-old. Like, she had her, like, second birthday here. Like, I mean, that even I was shocked when I looked back at that, that I had that sort of fearlessness, and also that I had a great partner throughout all of this, who has been willing to be supportive and, you know, make all of the, like I said, there's a whole bunch of people that are making all of this possible. And my partner is 1,000% one of those people.
Well, yes. I know your partner, and yeah, he is wonderful, just positive, and just a lovely, lovely person. And, you know, you're thinking about that, you know, how do you set those boundaries? Because you have an amazing, busy academic career. And I honestly, you know, one of my beliefs is that academia hasn't been built for women.
Yeah.
And so it's not easy for women, but, you know, you're making it work. You said, you know, with the support system, but how do you do that? How do you set boundaries, and how do you, I don't know if you can balance it or integrate or.
Yeah. I mean, I will say it is a struggle literally every single day. People are trying me every single day, in terms of my boundaries. So there is that, but I credit at least a lot of my boundary setting to the NCFDD program, the National Center for Faculty Development and Diversity in Person. So I did their faculty success program early in my academic career, and they are huge about like trying to figure out where your boundaries are, setting them, like don't work after 5 p.m., don't work on the weekends, act your wage, like all of these things. And that was really pivotal, especially in the beginning, because especially like when I, like we weren't married, like we hadn't had Azalea yet, like, you know, I could have worked all day long, every day, like, and I chose not to do that. And I remember, mentioning Shannon, I remember sometimes I would call up Shannon and one of our other friends and I'm like, we're going to Big Lots. Well, what do we need? I don't know, but we're just not working anymore. It didn't matter, because I needed that sort of stop and release to not be working all the time. And, you know, I think it gets extremely hard, like after having a child, being married, like balancing family. And I still try to not work after five, not work on the weekends. I try to preserve that. I set little, like, I don't know, carrots for myself as well, of like, I decided to take a trip to France for a month. I did it 2 years ago, too. As kind of a gift to myself of time and space. So like, I know that I need like time away in order to be a better scholar, a better human. And that's what I'm doing. And I'm also encouraging other people to do it. So the first year, like I dragged my daughter, I dragged my best friend, who is a doc student currently. This year I'm dragging my mom, my mother-in-law, my daughter, and you know, that keeps me centered, and something to like really look forward to. I also have these nifty affirmation cards. I'm really big into affirmation cards. I use them as a new mom, which new mama affirmations on Amazon, those cards are amazing. And then this semester's cards have been calm in the chaos. And today's affirmation is focus on one thing at a time. And I think that even that is a boundary set, because I feel like people have a lot of demands that say, well, you should be caring about this and that and this and that. And I can't care about all of these things at once. I can care about one thing and do it well. And then I'll get to all this other stuff. But I have to stay focused in order to do the one thing.
Oh, well, I think that's so smart, too. I mean, there used to be that, you know, talk about, oh, multitask and all that. And no, focusing on one thing, getting it done well, this is really important. I love the fact that you mentioned, you know, as a younger faculty, new faculty member, you had, you know, this cohort. And I watched, I was a senior faculty member when you came here, but just had come just a little bit before you. And knew Shannon, you know, from another life at Colorado State. And so you know, I didn't want to be like this overbearing, you know, friend, mentor, you know, person from the past life, you know, how you doing, Folly, you know, what are you up to? What, you know, are you taking time for yourself? Blah, 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 you know? And so it was so always so nice to see that, you know, she was with you. And I know that there was, you know, several other people in the group that you would do things together and have, you know, adventures out to Big Lots just to, you know, to do something. And I was, it was just so pleasing to see that, you know, especially also as a group of faculty of color, women faculty of color. So I know that, you know, not the whole group is always that, but, you know, that you intentionally came together and supported each other as you faculty members at a PWI, you know, predominantly white institution. So kudos for that.
Yeah. And I think it's continued to also be important. Like I think about even like when I came here, they gave me an option at some point. They're like, do you want to be in the new fancy building or do you want to be in this like older building? And before I could even think about my response, I said, as long as you don't move me away from my two people of color, I'd wherever they are at, I just need to be where they're at. Like if we're in a shoebox in the basement, like as long as we're together, you know, that was really important to me because like my concerns as a faculty member are often very aligned with other people of color, particularly in times like right now with executive orders and just an attack on DEI, which is like my whole way of life and research agenda, and having that solidarity of other scholars. That was something that I also learned like in grad school. Like I got affiliated with AHI, the American Association for Hispanics in Higher Ed. And that's where I learned a lot of that is like having a community, you know, we're not always going to agree. We're not always going to get along, but like there's something in having that community that transcends everything that, you know, the daily minutiae that we have to do.
Well, it was very astute of you too, to think about the physical locality of that, because I feel sometimes that in higher ed and administrators don't think about that. It's like, oh, well, you know, yeah, there's other people of color in the unit, you know, they'll find each other, or, but to be able to have some physical proximity to each other, so that it's easier to build that community and have that support. That is good. That is good.
And one other thing like that I have done in my experience in collaboration with other people that I think is super important, and more people should do this in various ways. But we have this group called the Chingona Scholars, which Chingona just means in Spanish, like super cool woman, maybe a little bit more vulgar if you ask my grandma, but it's a reclaimed term. And in terms of the Chingona Scholars, every summer we get together, we have a writing retreat. We go somewhere in the U.S. together, usually at someone's house. So you're like staying in their home, their space, meeting their colleagues and like learning about their life and kind of how that looks. And it first started out, we knew each other, but not really. Like looking back, we didn't super know each other super well. It was kind of nervous the first time. And just like year after year after year, like it gets better and better. Like the first years we talked about tenure and promotion and what, you know, what sort of things we were doing to like hustle around and figure that out. And then like several of us like took other jobs. So we would talk about offers and the job market and how stressful things were like moving around. And then recently, like people become like heads of centers, or I changed fields. One of the girls like became a department head, like, you know, and so the group is like growing with us. And it has been such a great learning experience. Like we have a group chat where we talk about, hey, I got this offer. Like, what did they give you? You know, I don't know. It's been a neat, like learning experience for all of us.
What a fascinating and great approach to building community. And because oftentimes people of color, they might be the only one, the first or the only. And so being intentional about that. And then I love that you have a retreat and spend time together in person, you know, because that's so important too.
And we're doing fun things too. Like, we're not just working. Like, we're going dancing. We're like kayaking. Like, you know, one girl's running. I'm not running, but one girl's running. I mean, we're like doing stuff. So, you know, it's got that work hard and kind of play hard as well.
That's so important. That's so important. Oh, gosh. Well, and, you know, as you, your career has progressed, another aspect that I've really appreciated is that you have been intentional with your branding and your brand as an academic. And that is something that we also focus on with Innovation Insights, is helping academics determine their brand, communicate their brand, because I think it's something that we're not taught in graduate school. So would you talk about your brand and how you've developed that and thought about it and strategies you've used?
Yeah, so I think I first started thinking about this whenever I got my first set of headshots, and I was like, what am I supposed to do in this? And I started thinking, like, well, I should probably figure out who I am and, like, how I'm going to sell myself. Like, so reaching way back, I actually used to work for career services. And so that was what I did my master's kind of work in. And I worked for career services. We did a lot of talking about, like, how you position yourself and things like that. And I was like, wow, I think some of that knowledge could actually come in handy right now. And so when I got my first set of headshots, I was like, okay, what do I need to do? I need a website. And please don't go to my website right now. It needs a little baby revamp, you know, in the past year or so. So that's the irony of all of this, is it's a little bit behind because of the crazy times. But in terms of, you know, all my pictures, like, match, all the wording matches, the institutions match, my information is highly findable. Like, one time one person said, oh, I couldn't find you. I'm like, you are lying. You can find me. I'm around. Like, I also, I wanted to hit multiple audiences, because multiple audiences are kind of, you know, finding things in different ways. So I was like, okay, some people can find me and I can control my narrative on my website, which was really important to me. Controlling my narrative, I think, was one of the big things that I wanted to do, because I didn't want people to say, like, oh, she's doing this, she's doing that. Like, I wanted to be the one to control that. And so, you know, I did my website. I had all the, like, headshots match, which is a big thing of, you know, when you're thinking about branding. You know, I made sure to go across Facebook, LinkedIn at the time, you know, Twitter, now Blue Sky. I'm getting into Blue Sky. That's my new jam. And so I did all of those things. I made sure that I was a presence there, that I was open, that people knew that they could, like, contact me, that I was also sharing content across multiple platforms that I wanted to reflect back on me. So, like, I mean, and I, this is no shade to anybody, like, other scholars who, like, put all sorts of things on their social medias, but, like, that's not what I use mine for. I use mine for just either showing kind of, like, a softer side of me, which is more of my, like, curandera kind of work that I'm really pushing into in terms of, like, Mexican healing, particularly from academia, but also, like, my professional space stuff. So, like, where can you find me? Where am I going to be? Like, here's the research. If you need a copy, let me know. Like, happy to send it to people that don't have access to, you know, journal articles. You know, what are we talking about? Where are we going? And I think that one of the most exciting things that I've noticed, like, from a branding perspective, is, like, people will know me before they know me. Many times, like, at conferences and all these things, I'll have students, faculty, practitioners are my favorite, come up to me and be like, oh my God, like, I've been following you, you know, social media and all these things. And my super favorite was this woman once from a community college that I had been invited to speak at. And she catches me before the event starts. And she's like, I just want you to know that, like, you are the reason that, like, I've revamped the way that I'm doing things and computing. And, like, I really just enjoy the work that you are doing and how, you know, asset-based it is to the Latino community. You know, and had I not, like, been very strategic about the kind of brand that I wanted to put out, I don't know if she would have ever found me. So, like, a lot of people are like, ooh, icky branding, networking, ooh. But, like, I don't see it like that. I see it as I'm trying to connect with people, and people need to understand, like, what I'm trying to put out there. And likewise, like, if you don't like what I'm putting out there, like, don't invite me. I did learn that, like, very early on, because before I kind of got on this branding thing, I got invited to a national lab to do a presentation for Hispanic Heritage Month, which I will never accept again, ever, any Hispanic Heritage Month. So don't ask. No one. But you know, I wasn't clear at that point, kind of like about my brand and what I was talking about. And I gave my little spiel, and then, like, it just fell so awfully on the audience. I don't think that they understood, like, what my work was about. And I don't, you know, like, had they read any of it, I think that they would know kind of what flavor they were about to get. And they did not like that flavor. So now I am very clear. But this is what I've got. That's what you're going to get.
I think it's so, so smart. And I encourage every academic to do that and to think about their brand, control their narrative. You know, as you mentioned, you have your own website. Most universities will allow or require, I guess, you to have, you know, like a page on their website with, you know, information, but it's very restricted to, and there's a formula. Usually you're just basically plugging in to certain areas, but it doesn't allow you to sometimes tell your true story.
Yeah. And I wanted to be able to do that. And I had an instance where an institution didn't want me to have a personal website. They forbade me. Like, you can forbade tenured faculty members from doing literally anything. Well, I don't know. Maybe now. But at the time, I was just like, thank you for the feedback. I'm going to continue to have all of these things. So.
Absolutely. I agree. I've had my own personal website since, well, the Stone Ages, when you could have a website. You know, yeah, you have the right to do that. You know, you're paying for it yourself. You're doing it yourself. And I think it's really, really, really important. And I like, you know, you've shared some really great advantages and the impact of having it on your career, too.
Yeah.
And opportunities. Are there any other opportunities that you feel like have happened with you being very strategic and intentional? I mean, you've made connections of people, but I know you've been involved with publishing and books and, you know, speaking at different events. And
yeah, I mean, I have utilized it incredibly for our book that came out. And so, like, that is a brand project in and of itself, like promoting a book. Like, it is one thing to write a book, it is quite another to promote a book. And so that was kind of the thing that I wanted to lead, was promoting our book. And so, you know, it's been that, like, promoting a book is a branding project. And so you have to think about, like, what do you want your book to do? Like, what audiences are you concerned with? You know, what spaces does it need to be in? Where do you need to be? People need to see your face. Like, they need to connect a human with the book. And so, like, for the last year, bless everyone's heart who has been on my social media or connected with me online or getting emails from me, because this book has absolutely been everywhere. And it recently was awarded Book of the Year for edited volumes by the AAPI organization. And so we're really proud of that. And I attribute it to, we've just created a really strong brand around the book. And I'm hoping to do it with next year's book too. So we'll see. That's a new branding project that will start soon.
Well, we'll have to have you back on, and maybe we can have a panel with some of the guest authors, or the authors selected for, you know, the book, the first one or the second one. I mean, it's just really great. And you did do a fabulous job of promoting the book. And many, again, academics don't think about, oh, I need to market my book. I write it. I need to let people know that I published an article or been giving a talk somewhere. So kudos to you.
And I have learned to be like, I don't want to say I invite myself to people's homes, but I have learned that I'm going to invite myself. Like, I'm at least going to offer it. Like, so for instance, this week is a great example of, I have to go to San Antonio for a conference, right? Like, I am getting some awards. Like, I have to be there with my team to do research proposal or research presentation, very like straightforward, that part of it. But I was like, you know what? I had two collaborators that are in San Antonio on this book. I need to be in contact with them. Like, let's see what can happen. And by inviting myself and saying, hey, I'm in town, like, you don't have to pay me extra. Like, I just want to come out and like talk about the work, talk about the book. Oh my God, you lied it. Like, I have probably committed to more than I should, but like, I'm meeting with a class. I have a presentation at the University of Texas at San Antonio. I have a presentation with San Antonio College and their like STEM faculty. Like, and all of this is by saying like, hey, I have this thing. Do you want to see where we can, you know, have some synergy? And people respond to that really well so far.
Oh, I'm sure they do. I'm sure they do. And again, it's just so smart of you to do that, because, you know, it's not, you know, that you're just promoting yourself. You're promoting the work, the impact of the work. You're getting it out there. And that is part of our jobs as scholars, is to get the work outside of the ivory tower or outside of our own institution to others and to expand that knowledge. So,
well, it's funny that you say that, because I remember somewhere pre-tenure, I was saying that to one of my colleagues, and I just thought that's how we all thought. And I was like, oh yeah, like this is my job, you know, I have a duty, like I've been at land-grant institutions, like I feel a certain way about like giving to the community. And then they look at me like I've grown two heads, and they're like, that is not my job. My job is to write scholarly work, and then other people can translate. And I'm like, but don't you want to be understood? Don't you want to communicate with people about your work? I don't know. And maybe it's just my like low income, rural, like community. Maybe it's just my background, but that doesn't resonate with me.
Well, I feel that you see a bigger picture of academia too, and that has led you to, and not just academia, but just knowing and sharing your knowledge. And you're thinking of other ways to do it outside of, you know, a peer-reviewed journal article that, you know, might be read a lot by academics, but getting that information out to others. And so I think you're seeing a holistic view of knowing and sharing what you know.
Yeah. And it's like, I wish I could do more, like, you know, like there's like so much more and such cooler stuff that you can do, you know, with the communities and everything. But, you know, that's sort of the next iteration of life.
Absolutely.
Once I get the kid in school. So.
Yeah. I mean, what are, you know, yeah, it is. I mean, you do have such a long, you know, runway and career ahead of you. And, you know, my thought is that academics, they need an agent. Like athletes,
some people do have agents.
Yeah, not a lot do, but you know, I really feel like academics, like all academics, need like an agent to help them think about, you know, how do I translate this outside? But then also, you know, I have an agent to take some of that off, you know, versus, you know, you having to reach out and stuff. That agent's like, Sarah's going to be in your area. You know, can we arrange this? And I know, wouldn't that be great?
It'd be so nice.
Well, yeah. Well,
scrawling people's names in a notebook, like calling them.
That might be coming someday in the future from Innovation Insights.
Yeah.
Because that's what I would love to, for us to be able to support people doing that.
Yeah.
So now you've talked about your edited book, and you've done, you know, several edited books.
Well, the other one, the one that's coming.
Oh, yeah.
I was going to say, that one is not edited. So this edited book, actually, like, this was born out of a very personal connection. So Linda Sachs is kind of this amazing scholar in higher ed, and she recognized that there were two Latina scholars both doing STEM work, and we needed to know each other. And she put us together. Lara is a sociologist. I am from higher ed. Lara's student, Sierra, who is now a PhD, she also is an editor for the book. And Lara reached out and we got to talking, and she's like, you know what? Like, we don't need to be competing with each other. We need to be collaborating. And she had this vision of, hey, let's like get all the people in the field and let's write something. And I'm like, okay, let's do it. And you know, we tried to figure out, like, is it STEM? Is it engineering? And eventually we realized, I was like, well, we should write in engineering, because that's the area that I am super passionate about and I think could use the most, like, push in terms of STEM fields. And it was really lovely because we just started reaching out to, like, all the people we knew who were doing this work. And you know, there came a moment, especially when we had our foreword, we were like, well, who are the OG people, like, writing about, you know, Latinos in engineering? And I kept asking, I was like, who's the OGs? Who are the OGs for this? Like, there's got to be this, like, layer of other people. And they're like, oh, well, this person. I was like, no, those are my contemporaries. Like, I know those people. Like, who's before them? And then we realized that, like, no one... like, not that no one came before, but like no one had put together and like really focused the work in the way like before, right before us, really. So like there were no OGs, like we were becoming the OGs for some of this work. And that was a really special moment of realizing like that what we were doing like had some significance. We were pulling together people who all cared about engineering, who all cared about Latinos in this field, who wanted to see it done from an asset-based perspective rather than a deficit-based perspective, so that we could, again, control the narrative around, like, who our community was. And so we did it, and it's been amazing in terms of connections. And, like, I've written, like, what do you call it? Like, recommendation letters. Like, my students have been on stuff. They now got connected to other things, like, you know, like we've visited each other's places, you know, like all of these things have happened as a result of an edited book. And, you know, we actually leveraged this book because, you know, we didn't necessarily want it to be done, because the bread and butter of what academics need, for better or worse, is not a book chapter. Like, they need published peer-reviewed articles. So I went out on a limb and I asked the Journal of Hispanics in Higher Education, JHHE, hey, can we do a special issue? Like, yeah, because I'm like, I'm not letting this party stop. And we just got approved for a special issue. So that now we're taking this issue of Latinx students in engineering and we're pairing it with policy and practice. And this comes at like a really unique time, just given everything that's happening. that I'm really excited to see what comes out of it. We hosted like several workshops at the, you know, big conferences. So we've got some like movement around like getting a group together. So.
Oh, that's great. That's great. Well, you know, we'll have to talk about the timeline for the special issue and, you know, anything that we can do to help promote it. Again, we do live panels and things like that. And so we want to have individuals on or, you know, the guest editors, you know, talk about it too to help promote it because that's great. You know, and I love that you are doing, you know, these edited works, but then not just getting it published and like, okay, on to the next project that you're, you know, regrouping, thinking, okay, how can we continue this work?
And it's not easy, like, you know, because people are busy and like, people got a lot to do. And I'm sure that there's some people in my like little crew of authors that are like, oh, another email from Sarah, delete. Like, and that's fine. Like, that's fine. Just as long as you know, like, what's happening. So since you're an author, but yeah, like it's been a real like fun experience. And it was such a contrast like during the edited book in terms of like doing the single author book. Like for very different purposes and reasons. But yeah, so I've had a lot of fun with the edited book.
So now your single authored book will be coming out when?
September.
Okay.
Yeah. So this is my like 10-year in the making baby. This all like started with my dissertation, and just over the years, like, you know, you gain insights, and you know, somebody, this person, this editor named Jane, she approached me at a conference. She's like, hey, I like your work, like you should do this thing. Anybody who's worked with Harvard Ed Press knows that Jane like has been like a historic, she no longer works there, but she was like a historic figure of like, oh, Jane's tough. Like Jane's real tough. And she was so tough. And it was one of the hardest processes I think I've been through since the dissertation in trying to clarify, like, who's your audience? What do you want to say? Like, what do you want to be known for? Like, what do you want the narrative to be? And especially now that, like, this book could be, you know, promoting DEI that may or may not be illegal. So the hope is that it gets on the banned book list. That's always been the dream, to be on the banned book list. Never thought it would actually, like, be a real thing that might happen. But, yeah, writing this single author book, like, took a lot of time, and I did it sort of on the margins of like a normal career. I didn't take like a sabbat. I didn't get a sabbatical. I didn't take time. I didn't go like in a cave somewhere. It was written like in random mornings and afternoons. So it's a real like love. So I'm hoping to like send it to a whole bunch of people who have interviewed with me and just supported me over the years. So yeah.
I'm excited for it to come out. So I will invite you back to talk about that, the book too. Love it. You, again, just a lovely, varied career and but well thought out, you know. Well, do you have any career advice for emerging scholars?
Yeah. So I think one of the like biggest, best piece of advice that my advisor gave, and I'll give it again, and I try to give it to all my students, is to have your own scholar identity. Like, do something that is yours, that you care about, that you want to devote your time to. How much ever time that might be. You know, because it's really tough to like want to continue to write and work and analyze. And if you don't love it, or at least have a very strong liking, it will become insurmountable very quickly. So having your own kind of carve out, I think, is really important. And also, kind of in a similar vein, like doing academia in a way that is authentic to you. And that was really hard for me at first, because I like didn't always fit in with all the, like, I didn't fit in because, like, I wasn't critical enough for some people, and I was too critical for another set of people. And, you know, I was too Latino for some people and not enough Latino for other people, you know, like, so I felt some kind of way about, like, what I was doing and trying to, like, infuse different things. And it was just disastrous. And so after a while, I kind of took a step back and said, like, okay, I'm just going to do what I want to do and what I feel good doing and see what comes out of that. So an example of that is, like, I wanted to use testimonio in my, it's a form of, like, narrative inquiry where you, like, talk to students. Well, in my case, like, I would have talked to students and got kind of their testimony about their experience, very politically charged kind of thing. And that really didn't jive with, like, my theoretical framework. It didn't jive with, like, me as a, like, person at the time. Like, I didn't know a lot about it. It was just like trying, it was like square and peg round hole. And I was like, you know what, like, I just gotta do what works for me. And I eventually went into a different direction on with phenomenology, which is all about, like, trying to understand the lived experience and, like, how people perceive something that has happened, which actually ended up being very aligned with, like, how I think about things. So whatever that might be, just really thinking about how you authentically move in this space.
Thank you for that advice, because it is so hard as a new academic, because you're getting feedback. You're getting feedback a lot. Solicited.
Yeah, I was about to say, no, you didn't ask for some of it. Oh, thanks.
Yeah. Like, I remember sometimes getting feedback slipped underneath my door or put in my mailbox by colleagues on items. I'm like, I didn't ask your opinion about this. You know, so you get a lot, there's a lot of noise as a new scholar and academic. And so thanks for, you know, giving that advice to be your authentic self and be true to yourself.
Yeah. And be willing that that authentic self also changes over time. So, like, I don't know, like, it took me a really long time. Like, I was on projects that dealt with low-income students at the beginning of my career, like when I was at Iowa State, and I did not feel comfortable, like, unpacking, like, being, like, I was an EFC back when you had estimated family contributions. I was an EFC of zero. So, like, I was super poor growing up, but I wasn't willing to, like, connect that part of my experience to the research project yet. And so I didn't for years. And then only now, like, with this second project and third project that I have on low-income students, have I started to unpack, like, my connections and started to live, like, a little bit more authentically and, like, why this work is so important, like, why this work is hard to shift in terms of our society and how we think about, you know, what people from low-income backgrounds can and can't do and should and shouldn't do. So, you know, to say that, like, even if you aren't doing it at the beginning, that doesn't mean that you have to stay there. Like, it can shift over time. Right. And so can, like my Latinidad or whatever. Like, I didn't have, like, Frida Kahlo on the wall at the beginning and, like, Katrina is all in my office. Like, that's something that has, you know, grown over time.
Yeah. Oh, such a good point. Yeah, you know, that you can change with your career too, and you can change, you know, and your brand can change too. Mm-hmm. And yeah, it evolves. Oh, well, I do always ask every guest, how do they define innovation? And so I would love to get your definition of that.
Yeah, it's funny. Like, I went and I looked up the definition because I was like, I don't know what the definition of innovation is. I was like, to innovate. And I was like, to make new. Okay, that. And then I guess when I think, though, about innovation, like, I think about creativity. I think about meeting needs. Like, I think about unfettered thought. Like, I think about possibility. To me, an innovation is also unstable and dynamic. So, which is a huge hallmark of, like, Chicana feminism, P.S. Like Chicana feminism is all about, like, the fluidity, the dynamic nature. Like, and that's the way that I see innovation as well. So.
Oh, I love that definition. I love that you brought this up. I don't know if you know this. When I was the founding director for this Center for Gender Research and Center for Women's Studies and Gender Research at Colorado State University, we housed it in ethnic studies. And so I you know, part of my life in was physically being in the center of ethnic studies. And I had friends that were Chicana scholars. And, you know, it's just, you talking about that in innovation, that just so resonates. I love it.
Oh my gosh. I feel like you've lived 1,000 lives. Like every time I talk to you get cooler. Like if that's quite possible. People are so, this is why I study identity. Like people are just fascinating. Like, full stop. People are fascinated.
Yeah, I have had 1,000 lives.
Yeah, we all have. We all have had 1,000 lives.
We have. We have. That's what's the fun thing about this podcast is, you know, learning about people's lives. And people are just so fascinating. I love it.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Oh, well, Sarah, thank you for being here and, you know, sharing your wisdom and insights and your journey and advice. And it's all that you do for academia. It absolutely is inspiring in so many ways. And so thank you for taking on systematic change that needs to happen. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you.
Well,
I know it's not easy. I know it's not easy, but thank you. You know, we need scholars to continue to do that. And for, you know, really embracing being inclusive and equitable within educational environments. So thank you for that. So appreciate having you here.
Same to you. And thank you for allowing me the space and to be in community with you.
Oh, I so appreciate it. I so appreciate it. And I'll be bugging you.
Okay. Understood.
Sarah, come back to the podcast. We need more.
Please
do. We need more conversations.
Please do.
So. Well, to our audience, please follow up with the links in the podcast and stay connected with the work that Dr. Rodriguez is doing. And make sure that you check out her website and her publications and continue to follow us with the Innovation Insights podcast for more discussions like this. Subscribe, leave a comment, and keep exploring the intersections of innovation, education, and leadership because they really are fascinating and there's so many opportunities. So thank you for tuning in. Keep innovating, keep dreaming, and keep making a difference.